This Edgar Profiles podcast is supported by Ping. Edgar is an association of national federations formed in the year 2000 to develop and encourage initiatives which raise the awareness of golf, both as a participation and competitive sport for individuals with disability. For more information about Edgar, please visit edgargolf.com. Your host for this episode is Tony Bennett. Ping. Play your best.
If it's not your time, it's not your time, says a reflective James Hourigan. James articulated those words when referring to the dreadful car accident that cost him both legs, but at the same time gave him a new perspective on life. Those who know James may be surprised when listening to him describe how he reached out to God and prayed for his life, his genuine belief that everything happens for a reason, and how he feels blessed to have had good people around him. Please enjoy my conversation with James Hourigan.
Ping. Play your best.
James, good to get together with you. I know you're in Johannesburg right now. Is it hot and dusty there?
It is indeed. We're praying for some rain here, Tony. We've literally had no rain for the best part of 3 months. So it's only spring, but it's already in the 30s. So it's a bit hard for a freckled Irishman.
But you've lived there for quite a while, haven't you?
Yeah, I have. But I don't know, with this God's honest truth, with this climate change, it's just getting worse. It's unusual for it to be this warm this time of year.
What made you go out there in the first place, James?
Gosh, a man always follows a good woman, I suppose. But I had a South African girlfriend way back in the day, and I'd actually been on holidays prior to moving out here as well. And I just fell in love with the place at the time. That was back in the early 2000s. And then, thankfully, I worked for a global company, and I was able to engineer a secondment at the time back in late 2007, and then a year later they asked me, did I want to stay? And yep, I'm still here. Had a little short trip for a while, short stint in Australia, but still in South Africa.
Great. Well, you obviously like it there and you obviously enjoy the golf down there, but I just wanted to start, you know, right at the beginning really, I guess. So Ireland, mad golfing country, everybody plays golf as far as people from outside of Ireland consider, but you certainly have a high percentage of the population that play. So, you know, when did you get a golf club put into your hand for the first time?
It was put into my hand at a very young age, and it was nearly taken out almost immediately, because I was a 9-iron, and I proceeded to break the glass in our front door with the 9-iron. So clearly even then, I don't know if it was a draw, a hook or a fade, but anyway, I wasn't allowed to play again for a few weeks. But I just played casual golf when I was younger, and then I progressed to playing. I played in the All-Irelands. I played in one All-Ireland community games in pitch and putt when I was like 14, 15, can't remember exactly, representing Dublin, which was my province, and played a lot of golf in school. But I was never, to be honest, at that age, you had a choice of so many sports that, you know, I played a lot of football. I played a lot of Irish football, Gaelic football, as it's known. I played a lot of racket sports. So I pretty much... I guess, as my father once said, if James saw two flies on the wall, he'd try and see which one would get to the top first. So I pretty much played a lot of competitive sports, and golf was just one of them. I played for the school team, but that was pretty much my exposure to golf until really much later on, until I kind of was in my mid-late 20s, and then I kind of went back to it socially and kind of got it down to a single finger handicap, and played a bit of golf in Ireland, at weekends, playing junior scratch competitions and that. But it was, I guess, only after my accident that, when I was kind of limited, I suppose, in the kind of sports that I could participate in, or kind of, you know, add a bit of value. I was no use to a lot of teams anymore, even if they stuck me in goals. So I kind of gravitated towards golf. And I remember my first nine holes was 9 months after my accident. And I'm pretty sure I broke 80 for the nine holes, but I know it was very close to 80. But I parred two of the par threes and I went, that's it, I'm going to play this game, and the rest is history.
Tell me a little bit about this accident, because, I mean, it's been reported that you were coming home from the gym, I think, and what happened next?
Yeah, it was, you know, everything happens for a reason, I guess. It was actually my second time in the gym that day. Funnily enough, it was the second. I was just feeling lazy, and I decided I wanted to go on the spin bike, so I hopped back to the gym for the early evening. And back then, I was pretty fit. It was like now, nearly 8 and a bit years ago. But I literally was coming home. I just entered a highway, and I wasn't even on the highway. I was in the entrance lane, the yellow line, inside the yellow line kind of thing. And a few seconds later, I was basically smashed, T-boned, I suppose, from the outer lane, from some combi taxi guy. He lost control, and he took me out at high speed in the driver's door, knocked me off the highway. And yeah, but if it's not your time, it's not your time. I mean, I was conscious for the whole thing, albeit my eyes were closed, and somehow I managed to wake up the next morning still alive.
I mean, what was going through your mind at this stage? I mean, obviously, you knocked off the highway, so I understand that the car sort of tumbled down a kind of embankment and hit a tree, is that right?
Yeah, the tree stopped it actually falling into a concrete slough, which could have been a lot worse. But I was also very blessed. I had side airbags, and that saved my life, definitely. I didn't realize, when I got out the window, I had the window down, so I was able to get up on my elbows and get out the window. But I didn't even realize I genuinely didn't realize at all that my feet were still in the car. It was that hectic. But I prayed. I literally reached out to God and prayed for my life. Lo and behold, an off-duty paramedic came within roughly, they told me, 6 or 7 minutes of the hit, and she basically saved my life. She did what she needed to do. They lost me twice on the table that night because I'd lost so much blood. God obviously said, you know, I wasn't good looking enough for his kingdom just yet. I was kept downstairs for now, yeah. So that's it.
I guess there must have been a million things going through your mind at this stage. I mean, what happened? Can you remember what happened when you noticed that your feet were no longer there?
Yeah, I can remember the whole thing vividly. It was really weird. I can remember the whole accident because I guess the airbags protected me. I know, you know, I only had, well, I say I only had, but I only had the amputation, the severing of my legs, arteries, whatever. So I was very conscious and on adrenaline as to exactly what was happening. I didn't know I'd lost my legs, per se, at that point. I only realized when I woke up the next morning, and indeed, they were afraid that I wasn't going to make it through the first 48 hours. But it's amazing, you are conscious for periods of time, and I was very conscious of all the people who came in to see me, from, you know, some close people from work, and that on the Sunday and the Monday, and my family got out. And I definitely realized within 12 hours, to be honest, I had lost my legs. But I was so chuffed that I was alive. I have to be honest with you, I was really chuffed because I prayed to God. I had words with him, and he obviously listened. And so, you know, I kind of told everyone, James being his superhero kind of attitude, maybe, you know, it's, and some people just felt sorry for me, to be honest. I says, you know, I'm going to walk again, and I'm going to do this, and I'm going to do that. And I did, but I did it through, I did it through, I think, a lot of support from a lot of people. I did it through submitting to the wisdom of others, medical staff in particular, surgeons, et cetera, physiotherapists. And I kind of, it was a 14-week turnaround from accident to walking back into work. And that was like kind of ridiculous in a lot of respects, but that was the way I chose to deal with it, that I didn't want to go home after rehab. Like, I was in the hospital alone for nearly 7 weeks. I had five surgeries under putting me to sleep in about 15 days. So it was pretty hectic. But I think, I don't know, Tony, I think it was just, I have this, it was maybe my pain in the backside DNA that saw me through everything, to kind of, and maybe failure is not an option is too strong a way of putting it, but that I was kind of, you know, everything is possible kind of thing. Yeah. You know, everything is possible, nothing is impossible kind of attitude. And I was lucky that it happened me at the time it happened me. I was lucky I had a positive attitude. I was lucky I had good people around me. So I was blessed in a lot of ways. Yeah, you just have to, you can either, it's a, you know, there was a film I watched and I reminded myself of a line in that film, and it was, I think the film was Shawshank Redemption. Mm-hmm. And Morgan Freeman was the guy who was an actor in it, and he I think the line was, get busy living or get busy dying, and it was an easy choice.
You must have been pretty fit at that stage, I guess, because you, obviously you said you were on the second visit to the gym. So that would have helped as well. What sort of age were you when the accident happened?
I was 39. Yeah, I was 3 months short of my, or 2 months, sorry, short of my 40th birthday. So, but I was fit for a smoker. I was training hard. Pretty much 5 days a week, I was in the gym doing weights and doing, you know, cardio stuff. And I'm actually convinced that God made me do it, so that I honestly, you know, I know some people might kind of sneer at this, but I actually genuinely believe that everything happens for a reason, and I still do, and I believe he made me fit to save me and to keep me alive in that accident, and fit is what I kept, you know.
So tell me now about the way that you had to go through rehab, where golf came in again during that rehab period, and how you've now obviously created a life after your amputation. And those are another three different questions there, but I guess they're all kind of linked together, aren't they?
Yeah, no, they are. I suppose firstly, look, rehab was... Oh, I'm not going to lie. Of course, there's a day or two in those 14 weeks before I got back to work where I'm going, I think I probably said it twice in total. Why me? But that was really good that I only said it twice in total, because I can remember the two occasions. I think the rehab, I was very lucky because I lost all my muscle mass in terms of my strength or whatever. But I was able to, I relied on muscle memory in rehab to kind of build myself up a lot quicker than maybe someone else who didn't use the, you know, who didn't do gym stuff and cardio stuff. So I was very lucky, you know, and that got me back a lot quicker. I think the golf part only really kicked in when I kind of realized, I went to the gym about 4 months after the accident, 5 months maybe, my first time in the gym, and I kind of said, like, what the heck am I going to do? And you'd see guys on the football pitch and say, I can't do that anymore. And as I said, I played my first nine holes of golf 9 months later. Yeah, you're right, golf has been a big part of my life. I've probably gone about it in a wrong way in some respects, in that I'd like to be more involved in the helping part rather than necessarily just the playing part. And certainly going forward, that's something that is strong for me, because I know how fortunate I've been to be given a second chance, as indeed many of my peers that are part of EDGA. It's not just me, of course. There's many others out there that have their own stories, and indeed I've listened to some of them. But I think for me, it was about waking up and trying to give back, we set up a trust, a charitable trust called the Breaking Barriers. And that's where we hold, it's nothing too sophisticated, but again, through the help of other guys, I'm kind of the founder of the trust, but again, I wouldn't have succeeded without the help of a few other people, including the lady who got me walking again, who's one of the trustees. And we have an annual golf day at the Wanderers Golf Club in Johannesburg, whereby all the funds raised go towards the purchase of or the maintenance of prostheses for a particular nominated beneficiary, a little young lady who was 7 at the time when we first nominated her, and that's now she's a teen basically, but obviously with her growing and everything else, you know, she needs ongoing help. And she, you know, had public health care, rather I had the best private health care at the time, so I was again lucky. But that's one small thing that we've been able to do, and particularly, you know, people I know who've been more involved in it, to be perfectly honest, in driving it than me. I dreamt it up at the beginning, and the name and all of the rest, but I wouldn't have succeeded without them. And she actually was born with club feet, got infected, ended up having to have amputations. Now, you can just imagine, I was a male, 39, when it happened to me, seen the world, all of the rest. This is a young little kid who was only starting out on her journey, going to school and all of the rest. So you can just imagine the things that she had to deal with. But thankfully, in a small way, we've been able to provide the at least the financial support so that she can at least, you know, if she has problems with her prosthetics, she can get them adjusted and new prostheses and all of the rest, and she's getting the good stuff. So that's and that maybe opened my eyes, and rehab opened my eyes again, how other people who maybe visibly had less severe injuries than me, and maybe not even, well, not, I don't mean not even, but didn't have amputation or whatever, and how they struggled. So you thank your lucky stars, Tony.
You've mentioned that this word luck on lots of occasions as we've been speaking here. You also are obviously a man of faith, and I guess, you know, those must be things that have been part of your DNA for a long time. I know we mentioned that you're born in Ireland. Was that from Southern Ireland, Northern Ireland?
Yes. I'm Harrington and Lowry country rather than Rory and McDowell country. Yeah,
okay, so you're down in the south.
I'm from Dublin, yeah, originally. So I think it maybe just came from my family, from being younger. I don't know. I wasn't someone who went to mass every day of the week or anything. But I do have my faith, absolutely, And I go, you know, I said to you earlier that everything happens for a reason. And I honestly, too many other little things happened that day. I won't bore you with all the detail. I mean, I was asked to say it all in an article once, but too many other quirky little things happened that day. And it was just really weird how it all panned out. So I do believe things, yeah, that they do happen for a reason. And I think that strength I have and that faith I have reminded me, you know, of course there's going to be a day or two in your life where you're kind of going crikey, and you're looking at someone on a bike and you're saying, you know, or looking again, as I said, someone playing football, or indeed someone who you're playing with. You get them back around the greens, but sometimes. But you play with your able-bodied mates, and I mean they're hitting the ball 30 meters past you, and I'm not the shortest off the tee, and you're kind of saying, "Crikey, I wish I could do that, and wish I could do that, etc., etc." But then you have to actually—it's actually a great lesson, because you actually realize, and indeed, as you know yourself, some of the best golfers in disabled golf in the world would not be the longest hitters of the golf ball. That it's about adapting, adjusting, being flexible, accepting what you have, playing to your strengths, all of that good stuff, and life is kind of, you know, that's where life and golf are kind of interlinked. I think if I was to criticize myself, I'm sure if there was a few people listening to this, they'd probably nod. But sometimes you can try too hard, Right. And you can get in your own way as a result, and what you've set out and what you want to achieve and how you actually are normally can get blurred. And I think that's been a big challenge for me. If I was to say what's been the biggest challenge, it's going from someone who played so many different sports, like literally anything and everything I played. I wasn't brilliant at everything by any means, but I was able to play sports, you know, and I enjoyed it. I think there was a lot of enjoyment in playing a lot of the different sports, and some of them I played competitively. And then when your options are, unless I wanted to do something in the Paralympics, basketball or whatever it might be, in a wheelchair or whatever, I think I chose, and no disrespect to anybody else, but I chose a different path. I chose, well, I want to walk again because I've been given the option. I appreciate some of them wouldn't have had the option, of course, but I had the option and I took that option. So I wanted to, you know, stay the way I was and adjust as best I could. But then you narrow your options down because I've found that there's very little sports that I can actually really play to any kind of where I'm not holding up everybody. And I guess that's been kind of my one regret, that sometimes, you know, you forget. Because I'll put it to you this way, the times I've shot under par on a golf course in South Africa, I was going around not caring about the score. And it wasn't that they were simple golf courses. You just didn't care. You had a big smile on your face. You probably told a few jokes. People told me a lot of jokes. And before you realize it, sugar, I had a great round today. Mm-hmm. You understand the point I think I'm trying to make. And if the harder you try, sometimes you go south. You go the wrong way, you know. And then you lose your enjoyment. And I think that happened to me for about a year and a half, where I just didn't want to play golf. Certainly not competitively. But we'll see next year, 2019. We'll see what it holds, and I might make a real effort. But I'm not gonna do it unless I'm really accepting that, you know what, you just gotta enjoy this, and whatever happens, happens.
Yeah, you definitely seem to be a half full glass type of person. And is that something that you've always been? Is that in the family? I haven't asked about your family, but have you got brothers and sisters that were in a similar kind of DNA, if you like?
No, lucky for them. lucky for them, I'm the black sheep, as they call me. I was also my grandmother's pride and joy, and my mother, and still my mother's pride and joy, as they say. But bless. Now I've two brothers, two sisters, all with families, kids. Very different to me. Probably a lot less competitive in sports, just had other interests, other passions. Really weird that way. But I was the first born, and I think my mother improved after that. but even my dad, like, and I mean, he hasn't been great, and I mean, it just like, he suffers from Alzheimer's stroke dementia amongst a number of other things, so it just proves that not all disabilities are visible. And he also got it, unfortunately, at a young age, so it's a wake-up call on that as well. But even my dad, the only sport he really played was, well, he played squash and rugby. Rugby and squash were his two sports. But I think I was the one that kind of, they just threw the whole sports encyclopedia at me and says, okay, go do your thing. I think I just did it for my brothers and sisters, you know. They had better things to do, I think, was their attitude.
Tell me what golf means to you, James.
Okay, how do I answer it? What's in my head? So whether what's in my head is, I think golf from a disability perspective, and I just mean golf, not being a disabled person playing golf, but golf has taught me that you don't have to be able-bodied to be able to play, right? You don't have to be able-bodied to play very well. It's kind of a level playing field in a lot of ways, because golf, funnily enough, at a certain level, I believe, is played between the ears. So golf has taught me a lot about the bad things about myself, when I get too short-tempered, when I lose my composure, and It teaches you things about yourself in life as well, but it also maybe teaches you the good things, that you applaud others when they do well, and you know that you could be gracious and this and that. So it kind of mirrors life in a lot of ways in your character. That I believe it does. I really do believe golf does. I think for me, as I said earlier, when you're very limited in what you can do now, sporting wise, and you come from a very sporting background, golf obviously means a lot. I think before I hang up my boots, as they say, I go back to what I said earlier. I want to maybe just give back a bit more. But whether that's via EDGA, via the Irish Golf Federation, in whatever form it is, it's something that I have a passion for. You know, we take a young guy from Ireland, Brendan Lawler, who kind of, put me in my place and maybe woke me up in terms of that, you know, if I want to do well again, I've got to put the work in. But I remember the night before the final round of the European Championships there earlier this year, and I met him and his family for dinner. And, you know, he'd come back nicely after round two. And I remember saying to him, I'd be the first to give you a big hug if you do the business tomorrow, you know. And, of course, it was a tall order for him to do. But so these younger guys who have it all in front of them, I'd love to support in that kind of way and help them. And guys that you don't even know about, or we don't even know about, because they're not even playing golf. They're not even playing, you know, disabled golf or whatever. Mm-hmm. But maybe they're not even disabled yet, but you could have disadvantaged people. So it's that kind of conveyor belt of people who could otherwise be lost to golf, because I think golf has been a savior for me in a lot of ways. I think if I didn't have golf and I was just doing gym, yeah, who knows? Who knows how it would have all panned out post, you know, being a double amputee. But I've met some brilliant people. I've met some guys in America, Australia, Japan, all across Europe and Africa, and I've listened to their stories. I've built friendships with a few of them that hold to this day. I respect other people's challenges, and I've seen that, especially when it's a bit difficult sometimes when you're in the heat of battle, but when you're off the golf course and you actually reflect on things and you say, wow, how did that guy do that with one arm? How did that guy manage to do that with those feet? You know, it really kind of, it boosts you, because you say, well, if he can do it, or indeed if she can do it, because I've played with some very good female golfers as well, both disabled and abled, and so he or she can do it, you can do it too. So there's been one or two people, I won't name them, but there's been one European guy and one American guy in particular, and a very, very successful American golfer, disabled guys, who've supported me when they knew I was struggling, and whether I really wanted to continue playing this sport or not. Both of them have imparted their own words on it. And when I listened to their stories and everything else, it kind of reminded me, you know what, it's all good. It's all good.
If you could give some advice to somebody who finds themselves in a similar situation to yourself. So you can choose the time frame on this one, but you can either choose the moment that you're tumbling down the hill in your car and dragging yourself out of the car through the window, or if you prefer, you can pick the time when you're in the hospital bed. And there is going to be somebody, unfortunately, who's going to be in a similar situation to yourself. It could be today, could be tomorrow, but somebody will be in that situation somewhere in the world. And unfortunately, it probably won't only be just one person. And what advice would you want to give them at that moment?
I would say definitely stay calm, number one. Just pause, breathe that air, and be very blessed that you can still breathe that air, okay? This is how I thought, for what it's worth, right? I'm not saying what I did was right, but this is me recounting my experience. Remember, I prayed for my life the night before. I woke up and I went, thank you, God. Thank you for listening to me. I think what's really, really important, though, because I was asked to meet, I was asked to go in and see some people who lost their legs once I had recovered. I was asked to, you know, and I quite happily did it, but I was very conscious of the boundaries. So I kind of more listened to them, and I was very careful what I asked them. But the one message I gave one younger guy who was in his early 20s at the time, and he made a recovery. It was brilliant. And he got back into work. Was, you know, I told them my story without trying to make me out to be someone special, but I kind of was balanced in telling them the challenges that lie ahead, but the pit stops that you maybe just have to take. And what was most important for me, and I would say to anyone, is and I remember in the first thing I was asked to write, recalling my accident, I said this, there was an Irish poet, and he wrote a poem called No Man Is an Island. And I believe that 100%, because there is no way I would have been able to do or achieve what I did in the rate of time I did on my own. I'm not someone blinking special that can just, you know, do everything myself. I submitted to the wisdom and care of other people. I had good friends around me. I had good work colleagues around me, and of course I had a very strong family bond. So when you add all of them into the mix, I was sensible. Is that the word? I was selfish in a lot of ways, in that I was preoccupied with, I'm on a journey and I'm going to conquer this. And I'm going to have people around me who are going to help me do it. It's like a golfer. If they've got a great caddy, sometimes they win the tournament by having a better caddy than a great caddy and not a great caddy. So, you know, you have to have the right people around you. And that's what I would say to someone. And I would also, what I said to that younger guy was, look, you know, I gave him my worst ebb, how I felt. I maybe dramatized it a little bit. Because I was positive, believe it or not. I wasn't so negative after my stuff. But I kind of brought him to a place trying to feel what he was feeling and saying, like, this is how I succeeded. These are the steps I took. And I think it's having faith in yourself. It's believing in yourself. It's having a plan, having a realistic plan. So don't try and do everything at once where you're setting yourself up for a fall. And I think it's, again, surrounding yourself with positive people, and people who are not going to bullshit you, and then keep yourself busy. So, you know, think of things that, even if you're limited, you can't hop back on a motorbike all of a sudden. When are you going to get back on that motorbike with your prosthetics, for example? You know, mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what I'd say, Tony. I guess it's a hard one to answer, but it's positivity is a big thing.
No, it's good advice, and obviously I asked that question to most of the people that I interview, and that certainly the positivity is something that comes through. I think also the fact that it's not going to be as bad as you think it's going to be. Time moves on, things change, and I think also what you say about keeping busy and keeping busy in your improvement, in your rehabilitation, seems to be also a very common theme that comes through from everybody that I've interviewed. If I was to ask you but how we could make golf more accessible, make more people aware of golf for the disabled, what would you, if you had the choice to do one or two things, what would you do?
Well, look, I think Edgar, in fairness, I'm not just giving you, you know, kisses here, but Edgar as a whole has made a lot of strides since I first got involved. I mean, it's allowed me to play in European Tour Pro-Ams, European Ladies Tour actual tournament with one of the Swedish Solheim Cup players, things that I couldn't dream of doing, being able-bodied. It's opened the doors for others as well. It's opened the doors for a lot of us. What more can it do? I do think that, you know, we all would love the Paralympics. It's a great profiler. It's watched by millions of people on TV. And that's something that I know is a work in progress. But in terms of, and that would also help with introducing, I think, more disabled people to the game of golf. That's the point I'm trying to make there. Yeah. Because you're always somewhat limited in profiling golf if you're not getting it onto the you know, into the Paralympic arena. That's just the way it is, you know. I do think, though, you know, golf, there's different people play golf. There's people who play it, they're single-figure handicappers, scratch golfers, they play it competitively. There are others who also play it competitively just with a bit higher handicaps, and there are those who just play it for a social, you know, from a social perspective. So you've got the whole spectrum. So it's about introducing and catering for all those different types of people, right? I think Edgar has made a lot of strides in terms of when I first got involved with Edgar after my accident. There was, you know, less than 10 countries, maybe 8 countries that were kind of signed up, 8 or 9 countries signed up members of Edgar. Now it's nearly 30. So there's something that's going in the right direction. Still would like to see the US, Australia, and, well, sorry, I think Australia are already there, but the US and Japan becoming part of, you know, Edgar or whatever it's called, right? But a single body. I think that will help with a number of things, not, you know, let alone the Paralympics. But I do think, you know, Edgar has its access events. I think where we don't do enough. I think we, you know, you get. As I said, I've been lucky to play in a few of these things and get in, you know, invited to play in certain big events. And I know there's lots of other guys and ladies in Edgar that have also had that, been fortunate enough to have that, right? But then you have to ask yourself, well, what are we as players actually doing to bring others in? You know, we're getting all this profiling or, some, you know, different types of profiling from playing with the pros and getting exposed even in front of audiences and, you know, like live audiences and everything. But how are we, what are we actually doing in our own countries to actually, you know, educate others as to what's possible and how do I say it? Just entice them, give them that kind of, wow, you know what, look at your man, he's able to do this, blah, blah, blah. Maybe I'll give it a go as well. You know, I do believe there's an opening there that I do believe that the golf associations, the affiliated members now of Edgar should be getting people. So much easier if the person's already disabled and they're willing to do it, to get them to go out into their communities, go out into the golf clubs, you know, do the ambassador stuff, but encourage others in particular who maybe are disabled. Go to schools, go to, you know, there's lots of avenues you can penetrate to bring more people into golf and then show them. You know, some of them may say, nah, not for me, but for every 5 that say not for me, there'll be one that will go, yeah, I'm hooked. And who knows? That could be the guy that's the next Juan Postigo. I'm just saying. You know, you just don't know.
Absolutely. James, just if anybody wanted to reach out to you and contact you for a little bit of advice about how they deal with their journey into disabled golf, or perhaps they just want to get a little bit of inspiration because they're already playing golf, but they need to see that somebody else out there that's doing great things in the game, how can they reach you?
Tony, you've got my details. I'm very happy to share my details and I'm really, you know, I'm enthusiastic about if I can help anybody, if I can help one person on one little thing, I'd be really happy to do it. As I said, I am telling you openly that one of the guys in America who I'm one of their top golfers who I know well, I mean, he's helped me when I've had to bounce things off him in the past. And what he told me was 100% correct, you know, and sometimes you just need to hear it and need it to be said to you in a certain way. Most importantly, he listened to me. So he could actually tell me what he really thought rather than coming up with his answer before he let me finish my sentence. Yeah. So I'm very happy at whatever stage, of course, at the end of the day, it's about sharing experiences, and that's what makes you better. I'm not just, it translates ultimately onto the golf course, but it translates ultimately into life as well. So, more importantly, if there's anything at all, I'm very. I know it's benefited me doing it with one or two people that I know from playing golf with them internationally. So I'm very relaxed about that, for sure.
Thanks, James. Well, look, I really appreciate your time. Are we going to see you back in Europe before the end of the year?
See, Tony, it's not easy without a sponsor, right? And it's not easy without a sponsor, and it was something I never pursued. But I know, sure, Italy is only 2 weeks away, and Portugal is later in the year, later in November. But I'm definitely going to. I'm shedding about 5 kilos in weight from training, and I'm going to definitely make an effort next year. I think the European team next year.
European Team Championship next year, and hopefully we'll see an Irish team in there for the first time.
That's exactly it. So I have every intention of, I'm sure I'll try and play in some of the individual ones, but I think it comes to mind in particular now that Brendan has come onto the stage and done great so far.
Great. James, good to speak, and let's keep in touch. Thanks
for
your time.
Cheers, Tony.
Okay.
Ping. Play your best.
Our partners are very important to Edgar, and I would like to introduce you to a short, true story told by Ping.
If imitation is the sincerest form of flattery, Ping's creation of the Ping Answer received more talk than any other golf club in the modern era. Designed in 1966, Carsten used a record album sleeve and covered it with sketches of his answer to people's putting problems, his first putter to use an offset hosel. The name was created with his wife Louise when she suggested it should be called Answer, as it would be the answer to players' putting problems. However, when Carsten tried to fit it on the toe of the club, it was too long. Louise suggested to leave the W out of the spelling, as it would still sound the same and people would understand it meant the same. The name fitted perfectly, and the answer, spelled A-N-S-E-R, was born. With the introduction of the answer putter, PGA Tour and LPGA Tour pros embraced his new technology. Ping putter wins piled up, and then the small company of Ping was officially up and running. The answer went on to become the most used putters for victories in the history of golf, and is still the dominant design on every major professional tour.
This was an Edgar Player story supported by Ping, helping golfers to play their best. For more information about Edgar, please visit edgargolf.com. Stay tuned for the next Edgar podcast. Ping. Play your best.